All right, let's go ahead and get started, man. First of all, hey, everybody. Welcome to Kerry's Corner for February the 10th, 2017. I'm going to be doing something a little different with this one. Normally, and still if a few questions pop up, well, we can definitely have a discussion, but we're actually going to take this this video, and Heath is going to isolate the audio, and we're going to put it out for free, just, you know, to kind of show people what we're doing, because you got to do that kind of thing. And I got some really good questions, some good stuff that we can talk about this week. The first thing that I want to address, I think I steered up a little bit of controversy with our most recent episode with some of the things that I said. I don't think, I know, because I got some messages about it. I was told some things that people didn't like, some of the things that I said. And, I mean, the thing is, I mean, this is an opinion show, and it's my opinion. And I think somebody felt like I was trying to force my opinions on them, and I'm not my intention to do that. And if it comes across that way, I don't know. When the format is you listen to the show to get my opinions on stuff, I don't know how to adjust that or change that. So I really don't plan on trying to change it. But I said what I said, and I said it, and I look at it like this. Scott, you're from upstate South Carolina, so you'll remember, because it's fairly new, there was a real estate agent, and there was this couple that had gone missing, and they got to investigate, and the last person they were seen with was the real estate agent. And then they started pinging some cell phones, and they realized that some of the signals had come from the property that this real estate agent owned. So they go out to the property, and they find a storage container. And in the storage container, there's a woman with a chain around her neck, bolted to the floor, bolted to the wall, and he's been holding her captive. And she says, "I think he killed my boyfriend." They begin a search of his property, and they find not only her boyfriend's body, but two other bodies. And then there had, about 10 or 11 years ago, there had been a motorcycle shop where somebody went in and executed the four people that were working there. And in the process of the investigation, they discovered, that's right, I've never heard you say I ain't your friend. That's right. So in the process of the investigation, he admits to this cold case of these four people. My point is, when all of that came out, nobody looked back and said, "Yeah, but he was a great real estate agent." And that's because what he did wiped all that real estate agent stuff away. And only with celebrities and people that we idolize do we seem to be willing to let it go. Michael Vick, and I'm animals. Yeah, he hopes that they got caught. We've forgiven a wrestler who killed somebody easier than we forgave Michael Vick, who what he did was awful, but he also served his time for it. And we forgive this wrestler sooner than we forgive Michael Vick just because we like what he did in the ring. And I think that's my issue. And I can't do it. And if I ever err on the side of defending a murdered child and people get upset about that, then they're just going to have to be upset about it. I can't stand it when people make statements and then come out and apologize. So I have no intention of apologizing for what I said. It is what it is. That's all I'm going to say about it. I want everybody to understand, if you didn't like what I said, and some people didn't, you should also know that Heath didn't like what I said and debated about whether he wanted to even put the episode out because of what I said. But that was, we put it up and it's on me. It's not on him. So if anybody is upset, or and everybody's going to hear this, by the way, not just the patrons of the group. Like I said, this is going out for free, so everybody will hear it here without him here, without he having any say in it. It was all on me. I'm the one who said it. So if anybody wants to get mad at me. There's no reason to send Heath angry messages, because he got some and he forwarded them on to me. If you want to be mad at somebody, be mad at me and send me the messages. I'm just going to delete them. I'm not going to get into an argument. I'm not going to have a debate about it. I said what I said, and that's what it is. Maybe I could have worded some of it a little differently, but even then, I mean, it is what it is. You say what you say in the middle of, you get caught up in the moment and you cut a promo. And just so everybody understands, what you hear me say and what you hear he say on the show is our real personalities, but especially with me, it's turned up to 11. You'll hear a lot of talk on the show about me not wanting to talk to people and me not wanting to meet people and me not wanting you to come up and acknowledge me, and I don't want to interact with anybody. I say a lot of that stuff on the show because in real life, I'm oftentimes, I don't like being in big crowds, and I sometimes struggle with carrying on one-on-one conversations with people I don't know. What's up, Brandon? What's up, Brian? But it's me turned up to 11. That's right. No pressure. 30% of the patrons are watching. So, like I said, what you hear is me, and sometimes I turn it up to 20, like I did on the Chris Benoit, Jimmy Snuka thing. I was just kind of, for you guys who are just joining, addressing some of the controversies that apparently I stirred up. I got messages like, one guy, like, I thought it was cool. He said, hey, man, I didn't like what you said. And I said, I can respect that you didn't like what I said. And that was the end of it. But I got some other, like, pretty hateful stuff. But not to me. It was all sent to Heath, which is, I didn't get that. Why, I didn't understand why they would send it to Heath and not me. And I think it's because they know he'll read it, and he may have responded to it. And I wouldn't. And if I did respond to it, it wasn't going to be friendly. And that was what the guy ultimately didn't like about me, was that he felt like sometimes I came across as I was pretending to be tough or whatever. And I mean, that's just who I am. It's not, I'm not pretending, and I'm not tough. I don't pretend to be tough because I'm not tough, but I'm not pretending about the fact that I don't read hate mail. That's just the truth. Why would I? I'm not a huge CM Punk fan, but CM Punk made a great point on Colt Cabana's podcast where he's like, man, when I'm online, it's like my kitchen window, and if somebody comes along and starts shouting stuff at me that I don't want to hear, I just close the window. So when people send me hate mail or send it to Heath, as I said, and he shows it to me, it's just, they just send one ear and out the other, because I can't let that, you know, I just can't let that in. I mean, because people are always going to, when you put your opinions out there, not everybody's always going to agree with you. And you know it when you start putting your opinions out there, that you're going to have to deal with that kind of stuff sometimes. And I'm okay with it. I can deal with it. But I'm also not going to get caught up and wrapped up in defending myself or whatever. So if anybody is waiting on an apology, it will not be coming. that's the point. Anyway, moving on to better stuff. The first thing I wanted to do, I always like, a part of the show I want to be to recommend a really cool movie or something that I've been watching or something that I've been into. So I watched this movie the other day, and it is called Train to Busan. And this is a Korean zombie film. And it is probably definitely the best zombie film I've seen since the Dawn of the Dead remake. And taking Walking Dead out of the equation because it's a TV show and it's different. But it may be the best zombie film I've seen almost ever. It's certainly better than World War Z and all of the bootleg B-grade, C-grade, D-grade zombie flicks out there. I mean, it's got a lot of action. It's a limited budget, you can tell. But it's the character arc of the guy on the cover here, who's like a father, and he's doing his best. I mean, he works hard, but he doesn't always pay attention to his kid the way he should have, his little girl. And the character arc of their relationship as they're on a train as a zombie outbreak happens. And basically, of course, it wouldn't be good if all the zombies were outside, so somebody who's bitten has to stumble onto the train, and it... You would think with a lot of these movies, what the mistake that they make is they'll go with a great premise like zombies on a train, and eventually they get off the train and they get into the open world. But this movie like goes almost the opposite way, where you have this entire train and the zombies begin to move through, and it just compartmentalizes and it gets smaller and smaller and smaller, where they're hiding, trying to avoid these with everything that's happened. And I'm just like, if you want to see a good zombie movie or a good, it's a horror action film. It's not like a terrifying horror film, and it's really not all that gory, but just a great thrill ride, a great film. Everything you could possibly want a zombie film to be, it says on the back, and it is absolutely true. I loved this movie, and it would get my highest recommendations. Now, I'm going to get into you guys' questions. The first one I got was from my man, Brandon. It said, "How do you?" Brandon, you want to know how I feel about the different brands of Raw, SmackDown, and NXT? And this is just the truth. I have watched the last two episodes of Raw, and I watched the Royal Rumble. And before that, it was probably around WrestleMania before I had watched anything, with the exception of I watched AJ Styles and John Cena from SummerSlam, and I watched Orton and Lesnar from SummerSlam. Who is Kerry? All right, give me just a second. I'll tell you who Kerry is. But how do I feel about the different brands? I don't watch them. If I'm going to watch, I watch Raw. And occasionally when like Samoa Joe and Nakamura were having a match, or Samoa Joe and Finn Balor were having some, I would always kind of tune in and watch those because I knew they were going to be good. I like the Revival. I generally will watch anything the Revival does. Other than that, man, I just don't watch a whole lot of new stuff. So Brandon Carey is a friend of ours from high school. And when we first started doing the show, he had asked me a question. And he's not even a wrestling fan, but he's just a good friend of ours, and he's always kind of supported us like from day one. He's been listening to us, and so he doesn't even really care about wrestling. He just listens because he likes to hear, I think, his old friends from high school talking. But he had asked me a question, and we jokingly called it Kerry's Corner on the show. And occasionally you'll hear us make reference to Kerry's Corner when I'm explaining. Early on, it was, what does this mean? What does that mean? What a terminology mean, and stuff like that. And then it just progressed to being Kerry's Corner after off a joke. So I figured when I started this show answering questions that Kerry's Corner was the best name for me. Just to pay tribute to him, because he's been with us since day one. But to answer your question about the different brands, if I'm watching something, it's probably Raw, but I just don't watch a whole lot of current wrestling. I watch old stuff, and I watch a lot of shoot interviews and documentaries, and that's kind of where I get my fix at when new stuff comes out. So Jeff asks, the best and worst manager and wrestler combos. That was a pretty good question, because we've been kind of talking about managers this week. So I just kind of ran down some of my favorites, really. It was, and the DDK show's legal representation. Anytime we're going to say something a little too that we may deem, could we get in trouble for this? We run it by Kerry because he is an attorney. So if you need an attorney in North Carolina, check out Kerry Trainer. I don't know what kind of law he does, but so when I think about the best manager and wrestler combos, the first one, like, I thought J.J. Dillon fit in with the Horseman perfectly. His whole character, and he tweaked his character a lot. If you watch when he first came into Crockett, for those that don't know, he was Dusty's right-hand man. So they were together in Florida, and when Dusty came up to Crockett, he brought J.J. with him. And J.J., if you go, and I'll find the clip when we get done here and post it there, when Buddy Landell came in, he was managed by J.J. Dillon. And when Flair, right after he beat Harley Race, was a tweener. So he would go back and forth. Whoever, he would kind of play the heel if he had to play a babyface, and he was playing the babyface in his feud with Buddy Landell, who had came in and called himself the Nature Boy. And J.J. would wear nudie suits, and, like, because there's in the promo, Flair even asked him, where did you, you know, Porter Wagner let you borrow one of his suits? And if you don't know who Porter Wagner is, Google him and look at some of those ridiculous suits that he used to wear with the sequins and the rhinestones. And I saw him actually at the Grand Ole Opry one time, and I remember he had on the cuffs at the bottom, he had two big wagon wheels. And J.J. was wearing those kind of suits. Well, then he became an associate of Tully Blanchard because Buddy Landell, for, you know, whatever reason you want to believe, the stories out there were they were really wanting to do something with him because he and Flair had some matches that by all accounts, and I've heard Bruce Mitchell was there one night, and he was talking about watching those two guys and just how great the match really was, and had Landell had his stuff together, they probably would have done more with him. So anyway, he moved on to just being like Tully Blanchard's business associate. And then when the Four Horsemen started, it was just such a natural fit for him with the suits and the Rolex and the tinted glasses that he would wear. And he could hold his own in a promo with three in the earliest incarnation. Three of the greatest talkers of the era, and the fourth being Tully Blanchard, who was also a really strong promo, but I don't think he was, I don't think any of, well, Flair was at this level, and I would say Ole also was at the same level as Flair. Arn delivered a different, more sinister promo, almost very philosophical with the things that he would say. But I just thought JJ just fit so perfectly together. And then when you talk about people fitting together, like, you can't think about the Midnight Express. That when you say Midnight Express, you think of the three guys, whether you like Dennis or Stan, but Jim Cornette is always the constant. Like, when I think about great promo guys, and it was a different kind of promo. He was not always serious. It was kind of goofy sometimes, but the whole, if you, early on, they would do the spot before the match started when Cornette would hug Dennis and he would hug Bobby. Well, then when Dennis left and they brought Stan Lane in, the best promo cutters and the worst wrestler, do you mean guys who could cut great promos but couldn't work? Is that, I'm guessing that's what you mean. So, you know, they would do the deal where they would hug one another. And when they brought Stan in, the gimmick was that Stan was a ladies' man. So they moved over to doing the gimmick where he would hug Bobby, and then he would go to hug Stan, and Stan would kind of stop him, and they wouldn't hug one another. They would just kind of shake hands or whatever. So I thought that was a great act. Gary Hart, who I was always been a fan of Gary Hart. I think it wasn't a sinister, it was a streetwise promo when Gary talked. You know, it was brother, and I've talked about it before. If he was talking about, you know, Ric Flair, it was always Ricky Flair. It was, and when he would talk about Don Jardine, instead of calling him Donnie, he would call him Donald Jardine. And And it was just this streetwise promo. But then when you put him together with Terry Funk and the Great Muda, and there were some other guys, the Dragon Master and Buzz Sawyer, but the core of that was Gary Hart and Muda and Terry Funk. And I just thought that act was incredible. And you can't talk about great acts without talking about Heyman and Lesnar. The combo of Paul Heyman's ability to cut he's top two or three, you got to think, promos, at least money drawing promos of all time. And to put him with a guy like Lesnar, who is as incredible and as phenomenal and as believable and as real as he is, when he talks and he opens his mouth, he loses all credibility because he sounds so goofy. So to put those two together, that combination and that package of this big, and when he's talking, when Heyman's talking, and Lesnar's just bouncing back and forth on the balls of his feet, phenomenal. Like you can't, if you could bottle that and sell it, you could make a million bucks, and they have. And then, of course, now when you get into the male-female dynamic, nobody has ever been better than Randy and Liz. I mean, from the very beginning, when Savage came out and everybody wanted to represent him, everybody wanted to be his manager, and he said, no, I got somebody. And then Elizabeth comes out, and she just looks like a million bucks. And then to watch that story arc of, and I've talked about it before on the show, where he would almost... It was an abusive type relationship, very controlling, and I think there's some art imitating life there, where he would make her hold the ropes for him. And you go all the way to his retirement match with the Ultimate Warrior, when he loses and Sherry attacks him, and Elizabeth's just in the crowd watching, and she comes into the ring and she runs Sherry off, and they hug, and he picks her up on his shoulders, and then finally, for the first time ever, she goes to hold the ropes for him, and he stops her, and he pulls her back, and he holds the ropes for her, and he gives her the cock of the walk. And they pan the crowd, and there were people crying, because it was the story arc of those two characters had completed, where Savage now respected her, and he treated her with the respect and the dignity that she deserved, and he gave her the cock of the walk. And you can't, it's so real, like at that, it felt so real. And then, of course, to be able to use that to go on and make money by having them, the match made in heaven and the match made in hell at SummerSlam, and then to use that to turn the Undertaker babyface, and you see where that went. So to me, that's the greatest probably of all time. They're the greatest two-person act. But you can't take away, speaking of Taker and Paul Bearer are a great act. I'm going to kind of go through the rest now and not expand. So you got Taker and Paul Bearer. Hey, I think Lana and Rusev are a great act because it's real. People know it's real. You can't beat real in professional wrestling. So when it's real, it feels real. When they were doing the deal with Summer Rae, everybody knew it was fake. So it didn't work. But to put them together, and she's saying he's the most handsome man in the world, and you may look at him and you may not think that, but she believes it when she says it, and it's real, and that'll always work, and it'll always sell tickets, it'll always draw money. I think when they put Edge and Lita together, I think they were another great act. They both played, who could have thought that they would both come across as so sleazy, but they did, and it worked. And then everybody loves the Heenan family with from the WWF, but if you didn't see the Heenan family in AWA, and I posted a clip the other day with when they turned on Ray Stevens, but with Stevens and Bockwinkel and Duncan and Windham being the Duncan and Lanza with the Blackjacks. I mean, the original Heenan family in the AWA, it just doesn't get any better than Bobby Heenan for me. Now, the worst, I think, was Bischoff and Hogan. Oh, Bischoff, to me, when he and Hogan got together, Hogan, anytime, Hogan and Jimmy Hart, I also have to, just was awful to me. I never understood why Hogan needed a manager. You can take a guy with all this ability, and you put him with somebody because he can't cut promos, and it works, and it enhances both guys. But when you got a guy like Hogan that's got so much charisma and so much personality, he didn't need a manager or a mouthpiece. And Eric Bischoff would just always had go away heat with me. I never liked him. I never wanted to see him. I didn't like him as an announcer. I didn't like him at all. He come across as the most fake person you'd ever want to meet. And I'm sure he's not, because I've heard him discuss things, and he seems like a very likable guy if you ever listen to him when he's not, you know, when he wasn't doing the NWO stuff or the WCW stuff. He's obviously a strong alpha male. I mean, he didn't get as far as he did by being a shrimp back. But I just didn't like him on promos, especially with Hogan. And speaking of Heyman, when you put Heyman and Ryback together and Heyman and Curtis Axel together, it did not work because it wasn't real. With Heyman, there had always been this real relationship with all the guys that he managed for the most part. And you could just tell that it was putting two guys with him to see if he could get them over. And it didn't work. It failed. And this one's going to surprise everybody. That's why I saved it for last. LOD and Paul Ellering. I never understood why the Road Warriors needed Paul Ellering. I just never. They, much like Hogan, Ellering to me didn't enhance the act. He didn't really add anything to the act. I could see if they were heels how he would have added to the act, but for them as baby faces, it just didn't do anything for me. I never was a big fan of Paul Ellering, and I'm sorry, it's my opinion, and I know most people won't agree with it, but that's me. And then when they put LOD with Rocco, awful. If you don't know about that, go back and listen to the Cringeworthy Show. So, moving along, Jeff asked me why are there less stables and managers today? And I think it's because Vince McMahon doesn't like managers and stables. And I really think it's just that simple, man. I think they like women to be valets. Yeah, there you go. You read the paper to them. Most people probably thinking, you just want to watch the wrestling world burn right now. Yeah, I do. But I think that they like to put women with guys now. And I was watching a clip the other day when Jim Cornette hit Baby Doll with the tennis racket. Well, when she did that, these outlaws rode into town, the James Boys, and they were going to get revenge on Jim Cornette for this. And it was, if you don't know, Frank and Jesse James, and I'll let you figure out who they were. I can tell you one of them was a big guy with blonde curly hair, and he talked with a lisp, and the other one was tall with a big handlebar mustache, and he kind of looked like Magnum P.I. And there's a great moment when they get their heat back by putting a noose around Jim Cornette's neck, dragging him outside and hooking him up to the back of the pickup truck like they're going to hang him for putting his hands on a woman. And that's why it does, to me, the manager or the valet, you can't get the heat back. So if Lana does something to help Rusev win, nobody gets to get the heat back on Lana because you can't do anything. But if it's a Bobby Heenan character, you can catch him on the apron of the ring and pop him in the mouth, and he takes a bump, and you got you kind of got to get over on him. There was a payoff. There was a blow-off. You put Bobby Heenan in a weasel suit. Tony's, yeah, that's right. So if you're not familiar with the saga of the James Gang, they were finally going to unmask the Midnight Express, face them on, I think it was the 605 show, and unmask them, and of course it wasn't Magnum and Dusty. But it's a fun little angle. It's kind of a playoff of the Midnight Rider stuff. But I think, honestly, that's why we don't have more managers and stables today, and it's just because Vince McMahon doesn't like managers and stables. It's really that simple. And sorry, my wife's dancing over there, so it's kind of throwing Carol. She can't stand it for me to talk to anybody but her. So, anyway. So, Brian wants to know my top five managers. I think I probably ran through them. JJ, Jim Cornette, Gary Hart, Paul Heyman, and Bobby Heenan. And I think those are probably most. And I think for what I said earlier, I think those are the reasons. Scott asked me managers who became wrestlers. And here's the thing, Scott. You can't ask me. You're like Conrad Thompson. You can't say who are the managers who became wrestlers and then list 10 guys and then say, well, who else? You got any others? Well, of course I don't have any others because you listed all of them. How can I answer that question? No, I'm just giving you a hard time, Scott. And I can give Scott a hard time because we've known each other since we were kids. I can give him more of a hard time than I would probably give others. But I mean it. You can't, like, give me 10. You can't say, what about this guy, and this guy. Do you know anybody else? But it did lead me to thinking really, really hard. Yes, Mr. Fuji. Fuji was okay. Okay. All right. Well, Scott, I'm getting to it. You want to know, imagine, I'm going to take the real world, the real world. In the real world, I can give you three. Vince McMahon, Shane McMahon, and Stephanie McMahon. Especially Shane, who is known for taking and they were real life men. They weren't just managers on TV. They really did manage that company. So I give you three. Vince, Shane, and Stephanie. So all three of them went from being a manager to wrestling. And especially Shane is known for taking those incredible, insane bumps. So what do you think about that, Mr. Hicks? Oh, I'm waiting. But it leads me to something that I was thinking. If you can stump me, if you can ask me a question that I can't give you a reasonable answer, and I ain't talking about them kind of questions like Heath asked, what color knee pads was somebody wearing on some spot show in 1987? I ain't talking about those kind of questions. I'm talking about a question like Scott asked, can you name me somebody who went from being a manager to being a wrestler? Yeah, that's what killed Dennis Day, contempt for the audience. So anyway, if you give me a good question, and I'm not talking about, DDP, actually, you're right, Brandon Scott, but Scott said DDP when he asked the question. I should have clarified that. So he said all he could think of was DDP, Sable, and Lita. And those were, like, there are not a lot, like, that's not the trajectory that usually happens where people go from being a manager to a wrestler. I thought it was a great, actually, Scott, I told you, it's one of the best questions ever because it made me think. A lot of times, like, a lot of this, like, you know, my favorite managers and stuff, like, I kind of know that stuff. But when you ask me a question that I don't necessarily know the answer to, like, I have to ponder on it for a little while. But that leads me to where I'm going. You ask me a question that I can't answer, and we'll send you something. And it ain't going to be a new car, but we got autographed pictures. I got a ton of DVDs. We got all kind of stuff. So if you can stump me, I'll give you something. Going forward, Scott, you don't get it this time because I don't think you stumped me because I think I provided. You're talking about people that have been in WrestleMania matches after being managers. So I feel like I answered that question truthfully and honestly. Like I said, none of this, what color was anybody knee pad stuff? Yeah, that's right. Heath is right. He'll send you something. But I'll pay you back in other ways, Heath. One day you'll figure out what those ways are. So Jeff asked about guys who were great promos but were not great workers, and I think I'm gonna say that I think the Ultimate Warrior And the reason that I ask that, or the reason that I say that, is yes, his promos didn't make any sense. Yes, you're right. Trish was a manager before she wrestled as well. That's actually a great one. we'll send you something if you can stump me. I forgot what I was saying. Oh, yeah. Guys who could work, or guys who couldn't work but could cut great promos. I think the Ultimate Warrior, man. Like I said, his promos, while nonsensical, at least they left you going, what in the world was this guy talking about? And I think he's a very, very underrated promo. For that reason, not because he was Dusty Rhodes or Ric Flair, where he could spell this picture out. He would just make you think, this guy's nuts, and I got to see what he's going to do. But when he got in the ring, he didn't really have a lot of skills. And I hear a lot of times people will say this guy can't work or that guy can't work. But I think differently. I think when I hear somebody can't work, what I think is that they hurt somebody or that their footwork's bad or they don't know how to lock up. So to say that, you know, a guy like Hogan can't work, I think is unfair. I don't know that it's unfair to say that about the Ultimate Warrior, because a lot of his, before he passed, a lot of the people who had been in the ring with him said he was very reckless. He didn't care if he hurt people. And that is a sign of someone who can't work to me. So I would say the Ultimate Warrior couldn't work, but I thought he cut a pretty mean promo. Why don't we honor Michael Hofer? Why don't we honor Akeem the African Dream for Black History Month? All right, so everybody needs to know where this comes from. There was a Kayfabe News did an article kind of about that. It was satirizing the treatment or the presentation, especially in the 80s and early 90s, of minorities in the WWF and the way that they were treated. And it's not always good if you go back and look at it. So they wrote these series of articles about Akeem to kind of shine a light, really, on WWE's treatment and handling of minorities. Now, I think they've gotten away from that, where they would stereotype people. I mean, I don't think, I know. I mean, I watched The New Day. I watch, you know, Titus O'Neil, Darren Young, all these great guys, and they don't get stereotyped with a ridiculous gimmick. But to get back to Akeem, the African Dream, I did some investigative journalism on this thing, and I found out a couple of reasons why we might be calling his African heritage into question. Number one, he spoke with an American accent. Now, I would think a guy from Africa might not speak with an American accent. Number two, he was grossly overweight. And you don't see a lot of grossly overweight people from Africa. Number three, and I think this one's the most important, he was white. So that was a joke. And actually, it went on to say, I'm just kind of reading from their article. I did steal this. I didn't write it. It said he may not have been African, but he was so tough that many thought he resembled an entire gang encapsulated in just one man. Akeem could not be reached for comment. So that was my attempt at humor. You know, I don't know if it was any good or not. Heath asks me, could I get a real example of someone being buried? I would love to hear an actual burial that happened. Heath, they actually buried my grandfather when he passed away. Number 10, Brian, no. I think, actually, I'm going to come back to that one because I think it'll be a good one to kind of close up on. Brian asked me, the Hardys, the Dudleys, and Edge and Christian, why do they get brought up as great tag teams? I think there's an entire generation of kids. I have one of my nephews who's in his 20s now, was a kid when all that was. And he used to come through with the armbands on his arms, and he loved the Hardy. He would dance like them, and he would do all that stuff. I think there's just a younger generation that really got into that stuff. why are they considered? People talk about them being great. I think it's really that series of matches that they all had with each other, which were train wrecks, and they, you know, they ruined a lot. I mean, they got to the point where, you know, as Heath mentioned earlier, you about had to pull a gun out and shoot somebody. And the Dudleys, I mean, I think they're, I get why people, I mean, they've held a lot of titles in a lot of different places, but you got to remember they started out as a comedy act. And then they became these heels, but even the heel heat that they got in ECW was cheap heat, where they would go out and use a lot of, I mean, they would fire people up and use some racially charged language and some homophobic language. And that's just cheap heat. I mean, to me, that's not good heat, man. And I don't think they really got a lot of good heat in ECW. I mean, they would almost incite a riot. But if you go back and watch, you know, Ox Baker incited a riot one time because he was having a match with Ernie Ladd. And if you, the story with Ox Baker, he had had a match with a guy. And Ox Baker used the heart punch. Well, after a match, his opponent had a heart attack and died. That happened. But it wasn't because Ox Baker punched him in the heart and gave him the heart punch. It was just an unfortunate event after the match. But because of the era and the time, Ox Baker began to claim that he had killed a man with the heart punch. And people believed it, because that was an era when people believed. So when he started punching Ernie Ladd in the heart, people were afraid that he was going to kill Ernie Ladd. And he incited a riot in Cincinnati. And I'll post the footage of it here in a little bit. But that's good heat. That's good heat. I mean, that's what heels do. But he did it by attacking the babyface and creating sympathy on the babyface. The Dudley boys would go out and get heat. I agree. I think those matches, for what they are good. But anyway, they would go out and get the heat just by anybody can do that. If you have the gift of gab, anybody has the ability to incite a crowd by using racial slurs and homophobic slurs. And that's not good heat. That's just cheap heat. And anybody can do that. Anybody. It's not good heat. No, I agree. And Brian, I agree. I think the matches were good. I am not a Hardy Boys fan at all. I'm an Edge fan, but I'm not really an Edge and Christian fan. I'm not a big fan of Christians at all, but I am a fan of Edge. I like the Dudleys. I think they're a pretty good tag team, and I think they're a good tag team in the sense that they've stayed together for years. I know they've broken up a few times and kind of done different things, but they've always found their way back together. And sometimes that's a good thing when you would have, you know, like the Road Warriors would go away and then they would come back. So you need that. You need that separation for a little while, but they would always get back together. I get why people like the Dudleys. I don't understand the Hardys myself. But I tell you, I've been to shows where people could get their picture made with the Four Horsemen and get their picture made with the Hardys, and the Hardys line would be just as long as the Four Horsemen line. I've seen it with my own two eyes, and I don't get it, but the kids love them. More power to them. They're making money. So back to the real examples of people getting buried, I think Zack Ryder is an example of a guy that came in. He did what they say, reach out and grab the brass ring. He came up with his own thing. He got over. People started getting behind him. They gave him a title win, then took it away from him, and then systematically buried him on television and then just took him off of TV. That's a burial. If you want to see a rip, that's a burial of somebody. You take them off TV. You don't leave them there. Because when they're out of sight, they're out of mind. And that's how you bury somebody. I don't think they wanted him to get over. I don't think they got it. They didn't understand why he got over. And they took him off of TV, man. And that's how you do it. I think Ric Flair was buried by Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff in the 90s. I don't think it. I know it. They did. They did everything they could, from taking him out in the desert and dropping him off. But the great thing is, no matter what they did to Flair, he was so good that they couldn't. I mean, they eventually tried to take him off TV and had to bring him back because people were not going to have it, because people cared about it and loved Ric Flair. And they were chanting, "We want Flair," and they were taking the shows over. They didn't have a choice but to bring Ric Flair back and give him something to do. And they could lock him up in an insane asylum. They could drop him off in the desert and leave him there. They could do whatever they had to do. But he's so talented and people loved him so much that they couldn't do it. They couldn't bury him, because I remember reading articles at the time where they would have Flair doing this deal where he was in an insane asylum, and it had the biggest ratings on Nitro. When they broke it down in the quarter hour, the Ric Flair segment was the one everybody watched, because people love Ric Flair. Ric Flair could come back today, put on a robe and a pair of trunks, and go have a match with somebody, and they pop when he come out. Because he's over. Once you're over, like Ric Flair's over, you can't kill somebody. The same thing happened with Daniel Bryan, and you're still feeling. And now, I think obviously they realized what they had with Bryan. Clearly they did, and it became a storyline. But I do believe in the beginning that they were attempting, when that's grow your beard and grow your hair and call him a goat and turn him and put him with the Wyatts for no good reason, and then just turn him back a few weeks later for no good reason, and have him get beat at WrestleMania in 13 seconds or whatever it was. I think they were systematically trying to ruin Daniel Bryan, and it didn't work because he was over and people loved him, and they kept him on TV, and every time they would do something ridiculous to him, the people would let him know. And I think that you're still feeling the shockwaves of that, and that's why I really believe that Roman Reigns got rejected, because that is not what people want. If they had brought Batista back a year earlier, people would have loved it when he came back. They would have loved it when he won the Royal Rumble, because I used to hear people talking about it. Man, I wish Batista would come back, because Batista looks the part. And people like Batista, but he got caught up in the wake of this Daniel Bryan burial that everybody could see with their own two eyes, that this is what they're doing. Now, they were smart enough to backpedal a little bit and make a storyline out of it. There again, the best storylines that always draw money come from a place of reality. Always. If it's real and people think it's real, even if it's been manipulated, if it started out with a little bit of truth and it spun out into a real thing that I can watch unfold with my own two eyes, people will always believe it, and they'll always watch it, and they'll always spend money to go see it. So that, my friends, if there are no other questions, and there shouldn't be, I think I've done my best. John, I'm gonna think a little more on your question, and I'll get back on the next episode next week. I'll be going live on Thursday, and I'll let you know what time. And I'll answer some more, John, from that question then. Until then, if there are no other questions, I will see you guys later.